one was really good. I was a little bit skeptical, cynical, things like a how-to type.
It was very how-to, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it was practical.
But it was. It wasn't anything that was like some of the ones that you see, 10 steps or this, that, and the other type.
Yeah. I think of it as kind of, I mean, to the extent that it's a how-to book, it's kind of a how-to the same way Proverbs is. It's a how-to that's rooted in. And very it's got some theological depth.
Yeah.
And not just that's all this stuff out there.
Refreshing. I was getting into it. Going, but that was overall thoughts anyway.
Well, let's go into part one. I won't try to use page numbers. Part one, chapter one.
Do you have a lot of the same stories we do? I know he had said that he had a day with different stories and stuff.
Yeah, you probably got a lot better stories than I do.
We got some good stories. So.
I'll just get kind of the bare bones version. he starts off in chapter one is all about how conflict provides opportunities, and he talks about different kinds of conflict management. Did you find yourself identifying, in particular with any one of those? Talks about avoiding, accommodating, compromising, competing, collaborating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that slope. I'll definitely admit to being quick to attack. And also...
You, Greg? I never really... You're just so aggressive.
And I mean, when I asked Hannah, she said you're more of a compromiser now.
And then, I think it's one of those, like, you just don't listen. When it comes to, and he really harps a lot into some good and practical stuff later on about that. But that it's that natural inclination to just kind of like, well, hold on.
Oh, wait, I'm going to talk about that.
All right. So.
There's some good stuff later on in the book about listening since you mentioned that. Yeah. I think men in particular tend to be really bad listeners. You know, usually... Exactly. Usually, you're not listening. You're thinking about your next argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I do think all of these different, strategies he mentions probably we could find times when all of us have done, these at least one time or another. One of the reasons I think this book is important, and one of the reasons I assign it for this group, is when it comes to life in the church, when it comes to shepherding, most of the shepherding type issues that you will deal with will be issues of conflict resolution. They'll be peacemaking type issues, whether it be between a husband and wife or two people in the church who have become estranged from each other for whatever reason, alienated from each other. Most of your pastoral issues in the church are different ways of dealing with conflict between people. Obviously, we need to know how to deal with conflict in our own lives. When we talked about officer qualifications, we saw that an officer is to be a man who is not quarrelsome. I mean, you could probably link several different qualifications to the things in this book as far as being a peacemaker, but you can't be quarrelsome, which the opposite of being quarrelsome is being a peacemaker. Mm-hmm. And so that's really, why I think this book fits. But I think not just because it ties in with the qualifications so well, but also because it ties in with the work of the office so well. So much of what you're dealing with is conflict resolution between people, helping people resolve their conflicts biblically. So much of it ties in with interpersonal conflict in different kinds of ways. Of course, he deals in this book with the whole church discipline process, which I think all officers need to be intimately familiar with. So that when the time comes, you can understand how that process should unfold biblically. So there's a lot of reasons for, taking up and dealing with a book like this. Even if it's not a perfect book, I think it does do a very good job of sketching out how issues like this will be dealt with in a church that really is a biblically shaped community, that really is rooted in the Scriptures. So, where he starts this chapter is that conflict provides an opportunity to glorify God and to serve others and to grow to maturity in Christ's likeness. And certainly if you're going to be an officer in the church, those are all things that need to be happening in your life. If you're going to be any kind of leader in the church. And there are things that, you know, we would certainly want officers to do.
What kind of knowledge of the VCO do we need to have, or do deacons have?
Well, so what we have is a constitution, and one thing I would say about our constitution is that when we put it together, we wanted a document that certainly spelled out procedures, because you have to do that for any community to be, well, as Paul says, you know, do things decently and in good order within a community. You have to have agreed upon procedures. But we wanted a document that would especially describe and help to cultivate the kind of ethos that we wanted to characterize our church, the kind of culture we wanted to characterize our church. And so if you read through our constitution, I hope one thing you'll come away with is, wow, this is a church that's very concerned about how the leaders treat people and how the people treat one another. Because there's a lot in it that I think is geared to that direction. With our officers through the years, I've talked, you know, our church is Trinity Presbyterian Church, so through the years I've talked quite a bit about what we've called the Trinity Way. I think the model for our relationships with one another, the ultimate model is found in the Trinity. I think this is what Jesus is getting at in John 17 in his high priestly prayer, where he says that he wants his disciples to be at one with one another so that can manifest the oneness of the Father with the Son. So we're one with the Father through the Son, and we're one with one another through the Son, and our oneness with one another through Christ is to show that Christ and the Father are one. It's to show that Christ is indeed the Messiah, the Savior that God sent into the world. And so there's a lot at stake in our oneness. There's a lot at stake in our unity. There's a lot at stake in how we serve and love one another and encourage one another and forgive one another and all those things that, you know, all those ingredients that go into making up a strong and healthy Christian community. So when we talk about the Trinity Way, that's what we mean. We really put a premium on how we treat people. I think, quite honestly, a lot of churches don't. There are other things that take precedent, you know, whether it's, you know, programs, buildings, budgets, whatever. How people are, I think this is probably what happened with Mark Driscoll, if you followed that at all. I haven't followed it closely. I don't know all that much about Mark Driscoll, to tell you the truth, but I get the sense this is what happened, is other things were more important than how people were treated. And you see what happened, the whole thing crumbled. And, you know, obviously, you know, having certain things in your constitution, that's not a guarantee that, you know, that you can prevent those things from happening. But we did want our constitution to be a continual reminder and encouragement to us to do things in the right way when it comes to treating people. And I think that's really what this book is about. That's what it comes down to, is how do you treat people? Do you treat people with love, with respect, with gentleness, with patience, with forgiveness, and also with firmness when situations call for it? Yes. Can you do all of those things? Tender at the right times, tough, you know, at the right times. Can you do all that? And I think this book helps you with that. Most of the, and this goes back to what I said the very first time we met, that, you know, if you want to be an armchair theologian, then you'll probably spend most of your time reading Romans and very little time in the book of Proverbs. But if you actually want to be a useful officer in the church, you're probably going to end up spending more time in Proverbs than in Romans. Not because what Romans says isn't totally relevant. It is. And you have to know that theology. That has to be kind of the backdrop, the framework within which you operate. But it's things like Proverbs and the social laws and the Torah that really govern our relationships within the community and give us wisdom about relationships in the community. And that's really what this book is about, is how to be wise in your relationships. And of course, this is really, you know, interpersonal relationships, but then you can take that one step further and see how easily it would apply to, say, elders in the church who are overseeing the interpersonal relationships of others. So it's not just how you're dealing with somebody who's sinned against you, but now you've got two other people in the church who have sinned against each other, and you've got to try to manage the conflict between the two of them. And how are you going to do that? And even the different kinds of conflict management styles that he talks about apply not just to conflicts you might have with another person, but conflicts that are going on between two other people in the church that you're called upon to step in and deal with, which is, you know, which is something that will often happen in a position of leadership.
Seems in this first part in terms of glorifying God, at least one of the things I struggle with for sure, obviously, is you always want to get to a resolution, a clear resolution. You know, maybe, certainly selfishly, you want to be justified in your argument being correct and the right thing happening, so to speak. But he reminds us that, you know, trusting God doesn't mean believing that he's going to do what you want, but rather that he will do everything he knows that is good.
Right.
And I think that's hard sometimes. I know he harps on it almost in every chapter. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know what, you have done all that you can do.
Right, right.
And I think just knowing and trusting that you've done what you're called to do, that can be hard, to just trust in, okay, this is about to be hard, and it'll probably fall flat on its face, mm-hmm. in terms of just, you know, if it's a reconciliation, or if it's having a word with, if it's the neighbor, and then, you know, they talk about the dog or something like that. But I mean, other little things that are just nitpicky, or sometimes, but then turning into big things, and you know, it can be hard to not let go of like an unresolved thing. But I think remembering, seems like that was definitely one of the biggest drivers of this first part. A lot of how you believe in God. And how you show you believe in God is how you're going to, every response to conflict costs you something. You must give up one thing to gain another.
Yeah.
And just remembering that how you respond is a lot going to show how you believe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So, at least that first part's what I kind of got a lot from there too. Just remembering, and it's coming down to glorifying God. It's coming down to glorifying God. Certainly, I think all of us can speak this. You know, married men, just it can be hard in the heat of a conflict with your spouse.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Mm-hmm. And then the wrong thing is said, and then you can see how God uses that for good because you feel like an idiot.
Sure.
And you know, it's humbling.
Sure.
But I mean, those type things can happen too, and just conflicts we can get in with each other. You know, hey, I wanted the last Andy Gale.
Oh, just wait till this Sunday.
Did you get it?
No, I didn't. He said there's one in the fridge. So
I'm sure the turkey.
So there's
bowl,
no fight.
I'm sure the turkey bowl will provide opportunities for conflict resolution.
Turkey bowl. I need some email on again to wonder about it.
I think part two is slowing down enough to focus on this as well. A lot of times, I want to get things done. Now, and I've taken the patience to say, you know what, I don't have an answer right now.
Yeah,
let's take a break, pray,
yeah.
Come back to it, and refocus.
Yeah, it really does talk about that too.
And then timing as well. When you discuss something, mm-hmm. what, you know, not always right now is not always a good time to talk about something.
Right.
Whether it's midnight or right in the heat of emotional stuff going on at one point.
Yeah.
It's, you know, spousal, but just overall, I can see that being from a leadership standpoint, being wise enough to know when and how, and enough to say, you know what, right now's not a good time to talk about. Let's schedule another meeting or something.
Right. Yeah, that's very true. I think so. Let me flesh that out a little bit, and we could come to this later on. But I'll go ahead and say it since you brought it up, Eric. You know, in Ephesians 4, Paul says, "Do not let the sun go down on your anger." And so in a way, you can say that, you know, that's the clock's always ticking on any kind of conflict. You've got till sundown to set it right. So, you know, if you get in a conflict in the morning, I guess that gives you all day. If you get in a conflict later in the day, then, you know, you're kind of you're done.
Pass sundown.
Yes. So what do you have? Till sundown the next day?
Yeah, he's got it.
I think what Paul is saying is, filling it in with other scriptures and so forth, I think what Paul is saying is it doesn't necessarily mean that every conflict has to be fully resolved by the end of the day. Sometimes that's not possible. But I think he is saying there has to be a commitment to resolving the conflict by the end of the day. So it may be that, yes, you did have to go to bed with unresolved conflict, but you went to bed both knowing that you're each committed to working it out, to doing what it takes to resolve the issue. And that may be true in your marriage. Because, yeah, it's probably true that if you're having a late night, you know, argument slash conversation, that there will come a point in time where it will be counterproductive to continue on because you're just tired and you're not at your best anymore and you're not even really thinking straight. So then it makes sense to say, look, you know, we both agree we're going to work this out, and let's, you know, go to bed and pick up tomorrow where we left off. I mean, you can do that. Eric's right to talk about the timing of it, that kind of thing. I think what he says, this is still in chapter one, and the section on stewarding conflict is really helpful, you know, where he talks about being informed. So, you know, understanding what God's word says, that God's word, you know, gives us wisdom and shapes how we deal with conflict. We're dependent, you know, and that's why he emphasizes prayer throughout this book. We're dependent upon God's grace to resolve conflict. We have to be realistic. I think this is what you're getting at, Eric. We have to know our limits. We have to be faithful. We have to be faithful. Faithful often means doing what is hard.
These four G's, is that something that you've taken and, I mean, literally, like, trying to apply? It's basically the four G's is for each part. Yeah. Glorify God, get the log out of your eye, gently restore, go and be reconciled. Have you taken it? Because it sounds like out of this, Ken Sandy has come up with like courses, and you had said there's some children's books too that can kind of talk about some things, and you could probably even call them up if you have a conflict that's...
Yeah, they've actually got
a hotline or something, yeah. Almost, you know, but I mean, it seems like it's really applicable. Like, I mean, is that something that...
I don't think I have the four G's.
No four G's? Oh, come on.
Yeah, missing out.
Four G's?
Glorify God, yeah. Get the log out of your own eye.
Ah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
It's just the name of each part.
That is the four. Yeah, that is. That is. Okay, yeah, there you go.
You have the four G's? Well, we're a 4G church.
Well, we are. I didn't.
Are you still stuck on 3G?
Oh, good one, Greg. Good.
Zing.
Man, after that, you know, nobody even tried to, you know, tell a joke tonight. We heard it tough.
But I mean, it seemed like it's very practical, because I mean, you've got to get to. I can see where you've got a conflict where you're called upon, or an elder's called upon, to deal with something between two members of the church, or it could be marital, you know, whatever. And I mean, just step it back and kind of having some principles to kind of grasp upon to kind of have that objective.
Yeah.
Because I can see where doing church discipline or doing just trying to be that objective observer can be really hard when you have a hard time being objective with these people you know well and, you know, trying to...
Well, especially if there's a conflict between two people and you know one a lot better than the other.
Yeah.
I think it helps center you a little bit, have, you know, I could see where this is. A lot of it's repetition as far as, you know, from one channel to the other, and kind of gets repetition and kind of goes back, and can help you to kind of center yourself and become more objective, or at least refocus.
Let's go back to
what is the objective here? I mean, what is the prime objective? It's to restore. You know, resolve this issue, restore relationship, and doing that glorify God in all steps of that process. I think, you know, that along with, you know, constant prayer, like you mentioned earlier, what he talks about is just, you know, trying to keep that center and keep that focus and not become partial one or the other, but
also
handle each situation with compassion and empathy and firmness when needed to be.
Well, I think a great training ground for the principles in this book, I mean, obviously, you know, you can point to, say, your own marriage or opportunities that you have in the workplace, but I think also parenting is huge.
Yeah.
Once you've got multiple kids, this is largely what parenting is conflict management. and so, you know, especially when the kids are really little. So, and again, you know, you go back to Paul's qualifications for elders in the church, a man must rule his household well. Well, that's one thing you could look at, is how is he as a peacemaker in his own home? Well, let's get to chapter 2, Living at Peace. Starts off talking about different dimensions of peace. Peace with God, peace with others, peace with them.
Yeah, it almost seemed like you can't do one without the other, right? Peace with God. It almost like that. There seems to be a hierarchy. I guess a hierarchy, yeah, a priority, I should say.
I think it's also a good, you know, especially if you're dealing with conflict between two Christians. It's a good. You have a commonality. You can start with what you have in common. You can start there.
That's a good point.
And then work from there, or where the differences are to see. You know, as two Christians who have been, whose debt's been paid, the same debt's been paid, the same Savior. Strive for that peace. Yep, with God through Jesus. There's a common ground there. So it would be a little bit harder when you're dealing with a non-Christian.
Well, what Paul says in Romans 12 is, as much as it is possible, or as much as it depends upon you, seek to live at peace with everyone. And that's a pretty good rule of life. Seek to be at peace with everybody. So you're right. With non-Christians, it's a different kind of ball game because you're not members of the same covenant family. You're not, you don't have the deepest commitments and convictions in common. But I think we still, as God's people, have an obligation to live at peace with them as much as possible. One thing that I think is, this is a section that, you know, kind of feels like it could have come out of Total Church as well, is the section, Jesus' reputation depends on unity. He uses John 13 a good bit in this section, and John 17. So basically, I mean, a big part of his point here is that our effectiveness as witnesses depends upon our peaceableness with one another within the body of Christ. And of course, I think that's true at an interpersonal level. A church that's filled with conflict between its members is not going to be a good witness. I think you could actually broaden it out, even say between churches, between different Christian traditions. You know, lots of public conflict is usually counterproductive to the spread of the gospel. Mm-hmm.
You would hope that would be easier to talk about.
Why do you think that's so hard for us? Catholicity, a peaceable Catholicity. Why is it? Why do you think that's so hard?
Who's us? Us. Wider Christian church.
Yeah, global. The church. The global church. Maybe Protestants. I guess Catholics fight too, but why is it so hard? Why is our impulse to fight? So, like, the shepherding, I mean, I realize that, you know, we sort of have that Machen's warrior children thing, and then, you know, all being sort of sons of Luther as well, but, I mean, that's not our everyday existence. So why is it that when we have inter-varsity discussions, we don't have them as brothers, we have them?
It's a pride issue, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, gosh, we just seem like it's... There's a pride bent on being right, and the differences are so minuscule that it's almost like the fights you have with your brother, where you are so similar to that person in your family that the littlest differences are the biggest
huge,
thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, and I don't know why I keep on going back to that when I think about fights within the church. And I wonder if that's why we have a split-up Presbyterian church and a split-up... I think it's that simple when we're talking about, like, you know, Pentecostals and Presbyterians or something like that. But it maybe went that way. I don't know.
Would you guys say that inter-denominationally that relationships are less tense than intra-denominationally?
I would agree. Yeah. It's almost like there's an acceptance of differences so vast.
Well,
I don't know. Or
ask, put it the way you did again, Michael.
I was asking the question: relationships inter-denominationally, so between Presbyterians and Baptists, and Baptists and Methodists, are more hostile or less hostile than intra-denominationally. Right. You know, PC USA versus PCA versus CRAC, yeah. You know, and SBC versus
Well, no, I think you're exactly right. Rene Girard, y'all know that name? Girard?
Name's familiar.
Stanford professor, became a Christian. But very interesting work in a lot of ways. But one thing that he argued for is that we think that it's difference that breeds rivalry, mm-hmm. when actually it's sameness, it's similarity.
You fought your brother so hard.
Well, yeah, sibling rivalry. Yeah. We talk about sibling rivalry. Or you think about, you talk about, in this part of the world, say football rivalries. Huh. The teams that are the biggest rivals are the ones that are the closest and the most alike. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. It's not, if there's a vast difference between you and someone else, it's actually very hard to get a rivalry going. Rivalry emerges when you find you have all these things in common, and then you immediately gravitate towards those things that are different about you, and that's what you fight over.
Yeah, sometimes it's even, I think, having to work to find the differences to fight about, so you already worked out about it because you've had that. It's subconscious.
But those who are most like us are actually the most threatening to us. They're the ones we're most likely to see ourselves in competition with.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's probably one of the key points.
So there. All that to affirm your observation, Michael.
But I think that's a key point there is that, you said when you say, that we assume the ones most like us. The ones most like us are the ones that are most likely to be in competition with us. I think we have that attitude as a church a lot, that we are in competition. You know, that this church on this corner is, it's like two gas stations across the street from each other. They're competing for business. I don't think that we should or can view it just like that.
Yeah.
It's obviously much.
Well, very right.
It's really organized. It's much more complex.
So the question is always, what dissolves that rivalry? Yeah. What dissolves that rivalry? I think ultimately the only one who dissolves that rivalry is Jesus.
Right. Amen.
Jesus is the great peacemaker.
And is that just a matter of, hey, peace be with you? I mean, kind of like a... golly, he commands. Looking in that same chapter, we're looking at Rich. Jesus gave his command, therefore, if you're offering a gift at the altar, and then remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar, go and be reconciled, then come and offer your gift. They're so important. Reconciliation with a brother, it commands us to seek it ahead of even worship. So, almost maybe we don't put a premium on peace.
I think that's true.
Maybe we don't. And it's because it's so easy for us to be settled in our prideful corner.
Sure.
Right? And so,
we're not good enough at reconciling even in our personal
lives
that we don't... we kind of know what it feels like. We sort of have that body sense.
Exactly.
Knowledge of what it's like just to get by in conflict that we don't... understand.
We said earlier, but the peace requires sacrifice. There are compromises to be made to partner with people. You can't have it all your way. If you're going to come, say, two churches are going to come together on a project, you got, different ways of doing things, different, just in a very practical sense. It's
I think apathy plays into it as well. You think about the interdenomination versus intra. There's a lot of talking about pushing circles between petty communion or theology, that and the other, but yet you don't see much fuss about between Baptist theology or Presbyterian. Ain't much discussion about that anymore. It's kind of been done. Right. They're just Baptists. Going the other, or they're Methodists. There's not much up in arms about things which could be
Just so many of
them. Yeah. So many apathy or just gotten callous to or complacent with certain theological differences, and others you haven't. And it's, cycles around.
It's been neat to see, Trinity House / Theopolis now. What were those lectures or
lectures?
It just speaks volumes. Of course I'm saying that from my, I'm in the Trinity Presbyterian Church where Peter Lionheart's the one setting it up, take pride. But I think it's a wonderful way of showing reaching across the aisle and engaging in just good, meaningful conversations, what it seemed to do. mm-hmm. from what, you know, this earlier this year. Would y'all agree, those who attended more of them, I guess, or more of the stuff with Timothy George? Than,
yeah, it was super, you know, it was a little awkward.
It was? Okay.
Yeah, and yeah. it was not...
I mean,
not
I only went there that
well,
Saturday.
Well, it wasn't super well attended, but here's a good thing. It was for the group of people that were there. It was pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's precedent, if it's anything.
That's true, too.
That,
okay.
That, yeah. you know, I mean, this thing with the Robert...
Coming up, the one that's coming up.
Just did a piece for that for them. I can't remember his name. Catholic guy.
It's so Catholic coming
these,
up.
Yeah, he's okay. coming out at Evan lectures. I mean,
okay. That's right.
I think that potentially that could be really well attended.
Yeah,
right. Wilkins.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
But I mean, those type things, are those the things we need to be doing to be seeking peace? I mean,
well, I think that's one ingredient.
Yeah,
there are lots of levels at which that kind of thing needs to take place. I mean, I think the main, you know, the reality is none of us, you know, are likely to ever be in any kind of position where we can do anything about the broad divisions within the Christian
right.
world.
Well, what does that say to the world about our peace?
Yeah, well, I think that it means we're sending mixed messages.
Right.
But I think what we can do is you come into contact with Christians of different types, different traditions all the time, and you can love them as brothers and sisters in Christ. So you do have those opportunities. And of course, you love non-Christians too, not because you have a brotherhood with them, but because, again, we're called to live at peace with everybody as much as it depends upon us. So that's what we strive for. He's got an interesting section here on the enemy of peace. You know, if you think about it, if Jesus is praying for this peace, and if Jesus has staked his reputation on our peace with one another, and the effectiveness of our mission in the world in large measure depends upon our peace with other Christians, our unity with other Christians, then obviously the most strategic thing for Satan to do is to undermine that peace and to attack that peace, which, I mean, you know, we could say he's done a pretty good job of that
sure.
in a lot of ways. Yeah. So instead of, you know, if Jesus works to promote peace, Satan works to promote conflict. And you can find all kinds of ways in which Satan has done that. But it's, you know, if you, I think one of the things that's, I mean, are y'all familiar with the Screwtape letters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you kind of know how that works. I mean, if you think about it from the satanic perspective, you know, what are all the things you would do to sow discord amongst the brethren and to stir up strife among God's people and create rivalry and envy and factions and all that? Well, it's okay, then those are the very things that we should be very vigilant to guard ourselves against. Those are the things Satan's going to use to undermine the gospel in the world, and so we need to be aware of those things. He's got that section, strive like a gladiator. I assume you guys have that same section, but where he talks about you know, basically that it's work. I mean, it's, you know, people have said of marriage, you know, for a bad marriage to stay bad, nobody has to do anything. But for a good marriage to stay good, it takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same you could say is true of all, you know, peace within all relationships. It doesn't really take any effort to, you know, for a conflict to go unresolved or for bitterness to grow. But to maintain good, healthy, proper, loving relationships within the body, that takes constant work, constant mm-hmm. effort. And I think you see that reflected in the New Testament. Always one another in commands throughout the New Testament. Obviously, those things are difficult to do, but we're required to do those things. I really like this section on lawsuits among believers. This is one of those things that I think is really... Yeah, the quote from Warren Berger from 1982. I'll just read this. You know, 1 Corinthians 6 is the classic passage on this, where Paul laments the fact that Christians are taking other Christians to court. And so he basically, you know, says that it'd be better to just let yourself be wronged, you know, than to bring such shame on the church, the shame of one Christian dragging another before a pagan judge for resolution. Basically, the church ought to be able to deal with these kinds of things in-house. There's no reason to go before a pagan court. Warren Berger said this in 1982, and I think it's just fascinating. One reason our courts have become overburdened is that Americans are increasingly turning to the courts for relief from a range of personal distresses and anxieties. Can you want to say, man, that was true in 82. I mean, it seems like it's even more true today. Remedies for personal wrongs that once were considered the responsibility of institutions other than the courts are now boldly asserted as legal entitlements. The courts have been expected to fill the void created by the decline of the church, family, and neighborhood unity. And I think that's exactly right. And actually, we have reversed the situation of the early church. You know, Paul here talks about how, you know, don't you have wise judges amongst yourselves who can judge a dispute between believers?
And we said, no, we shirked it off.
Well, there were times in the early church, you know, this is one of those things that's come down as a matter of historical record, where pagans would actually go to Christian pastors and bishops to have their disputes settled because they knew that's where you could get a fair and just resolution by a judge who wouldn't take a bribe. I mean, bribing was just a way of life. And that's part of what's being dealt with in 1 Corinthians 6 is most likely, you know, you got these kind of socioeconomic issues in the background of 1 Corinthians. The rich would take the poor to court because they could bribe the judge and always get a verdict in their favor. It's very easy to do. You know, the court system was so corrupt. So it kind of played into favoring those who had the most economic resources. And of course, one thing that the Christian tradition has always said is no, you know, justice is blind to those things. I mean, in the Torah says again and again, don't show favoritism to the rich over the poor. You know, treat everyone with equity, treat everyone the same. There's one law for the rich and the poor. What I think Berger is getting at here is that because we have so privatized the church, because the church really no longer functions as a public governmental institution, because the church no longer functions as a distinct culture. I mean, you think about the way that the church is described in the New Testament. Peter calls the church a royal priesthood, basically calls the church a new Israel. Okay? That means the church is a nation. Okay, now, it's a unique nation in that it doesn't have geopolitical boundaries. When we think of nations as having
boundaries.
The church doesn't have geopolitical boundaries, but you think of all the other features of a nation in terms of, you know, a nation has a government and it has rulers and laws and symbols and customs and courts, and I mean, you could go, you know, go on and on with listing the different features or facets of national life. Those are things in a way that the church ought to have, you know, of her own. Now, sometimes if the church is really successful in discipling a particular nation or culture, the differences between the church as a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and the nation of which she is a part, the earthly nation of which she is a part, it may not look all that distinct because the church has been so successful in discipling that nation. But in other situations where the church has, you know, where that discipleship process hasn't yet happened and the leaven of the gospel has not worked its way through, you know, to permeate the whole batch of dough, the whole of the culture in which the church finds herself, the church is going to very much look like a counterculture and a kind of alternative city within the city, a kind of, you know, nation within and above the nation. And I think that's what Paul's getting at in 1 Corinthians 6. It's like, you know, the church is her own government. She has her own court system. She has her own government, her own culture. Don't be resorting to the pagans to resolve these things, because what that would mean is that the church really is nothing more than just a religious club that doesn't have any kind of governmental authority or agency in the world. And that's not what Paul wants. So I think there's an ecclesiological issue. There's an ecclesiology bound up in what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6. And I think we've largely lost it in America by the ways in which we've privatized. And this goes back to what, you know, Tim Chester says in his attacks on the church as an institution. I think this is one of the things that gets lost. In order for the church to have a system of courts that could resolve these kind of disputes, the church has to function as an institution in certain ways with officers, with rulers. And I think that's what Paul's expecting. I mean, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, if you have disputes about such matters, appoint as judges even men of little account in the church. So I think he's saying even men who are poor and don't seem to have accomplished very much or don't seem to be as educated, even appoint them as judges, because that would be better than dragging one another before a pagan judge and a pagan court to have a Christian dispute resolved. You know, one brother goes to law against another, and this in front of unbelievers. So that's doing the very opposite that we're supposed to be doing, which is showing the world the unity of Christ. And so when we talk about the church as an alternative city, you know, city on a hill like Jesus said, or a nation within and above the nations of the earth, really what I think those kinds of Bible passages are doing is saying, look, the church ought to be the model community. The church ought to show the world around what human life under the lordship of Christ really looks like and how great it is, how wonderful it is. So it's a Deuteronomy 4 kind of effect. If Israel obeyed the law, all the nations around would have looked at Israel and marveled at the wisdom of her God who gave her such an incredibly wonderful law system and would have been drawn to that, attracted to it through their way of life. And I think that's what Jesus wants for his church, is for us to show the world by our way of life that living under the lordship of Christ is the only truly human way to live. And you know, this goes back to the early church. One of the pagans, I forget which one it was, but in his observations of the church, he said of the Christians, they alone know how to live. He looked at how Christians were in their marriages and at work and these different facets of, you know, how Christians live their life. And he said of Christians, they alone know how to live. They look at the church and say, they've got it right. You know, they've got it figured out. That kind of thing doesn't happen today because we're so muddled.
Right. That's a good way to appeal to someone that is not, or is dragging their feet, or trying to avoid being disciplined in the church. That's a good way to appeal to them. Like, this is good for your flourishing as a human being.
Absolutely.
Without respect to your obedience to God, even. I mean, those are one and the same thing, but I feel like it's, people a lot of times don't like you telling them that what they're doing is unbiblical or because they feel like you're trying to be their Holy Spirit, so to speak. I guess I'm speaking about specific people in my life.
I think you're right. One of the Dutch Reformed theologians, A.A. Van Ruler, said, we don't become Christians merely to be saved. We become Christians that we might be truly human. That's a great way to think about it. Sin dehumanizes, and salvation, including repentance from sin and beginning to live the way God wants us to live, rehumanizes us. We begin to live the way God really wants us to live, the way God designed us to live, the way we were made to live.
So instead of referring to natural law, what is the category for what you just said? Using sin?
I don't have a problem with natural law, so long as we understand that God is the one who designed nature, and God is the one who has revealed the laws according to which our natures are to function.
So you can freely go in and out of biblical, language and more natural, all men language without skipping a beat, I guess, without defining your terms.
Well, I mean, I have no problem defining terms, but yeah, I mean, I would say that the natural law, rightly understood, coincides with, I guess you could say, biblical morality. Because God is the designer of the world and the one who's given us the law that shows us how we ought to live in this world. So that when we live according to God's law, we're going with the grain of our created nature. And if you violate God's law, you're going against the grain. And you know what happens if you rub your hand against the grain of the wood? You get splinters and it hurts. You're not supposed to run your hand against the grain of the wood. But that's what happens when you don't live God's way.
Right.
You're violating your own nature. That's what Paul says about homosexuality in Romans 1, that the men and the women who commit, you know, same-sex acts are acting contrary to their nature. They're doing what is unnatural. It's contrary to God's design.
Touches on kind of what you were saying at the end of this section too, that the primary benefit of resolving disputes through the church is that it preserves our witness for Christ.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's supposed to be that city on the hill, right?
Right.
The results bring praise to God, glorify God, by showing the power of the gospel, that God really has delivered us from our sins, and he is actively working in us to conform us to the likeness of his Son. So, it struck me, I think we can all think of things that are, you know, amazing that we've seen that have been done, I guess, through the church either, you know, the martyrs or through just the church history, you know, or even things that we've seen personally and stuff. And it is a wonder, you know, kind of like just the paradox of Christianity. Sin leads to death. So why would God die for us? To save us from sin. It's his act of grace just completely
overwhelming us. The grace is the paradox.
Well, I mean, naturally, what would you think? Sin leads to death, and we deserve death.
I see. Yeah.
But like, why would I even believe? Why should I even believe that I'm saved from that if I know that, like you're saying, unnatural things? And so again, this goes back to just basics of Christianity, I guess. But I mean, the wonder of. I remember that movie, and I think, and he actually brings it up. I think in here. To End All.
End All Wars.
Yeah, the book and the movie. I mean, it's just that. That's an incredible story of. I mean, it just hits you, you know, the gospel in action, you know? And I mean, these are ways to be that witness for Christ, you know, when conflict, which naturally in our world is to say, sue you, you know?
I really didn't know any...
I mean, it's a huge... I guess I'm saying from a weightiness,
yeah,
it's a huge weightiness. Go ahead.
I went to a big public school and didn't really know any other guys who were believers in my grade. I mean, I did through, you know, our church's youth group and in the grades above and below me. But my senior year, there's this guy that I got to be good friends with, super nice guy, but had never been to church. And his name was Jamie Wamsley. And the Wombat, he was known as. kind of a big, plump guy, you know, kind of rotund.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I started asking the Wombat he started hanging out with some guys that I knew from church and came to our Bible study off and on. And I mean, to make a long story short, actually our senior year, probably about halfway through our senior year, converted. Became a Christian, and
the Wombat
did, and the change in his life was really instantaneous. But here's this guy, I mean, he's, you know, 17, 18 years old, he becomes a Christian, his family, you know, has, you know, doesn't know anything about this, they really have no clue, they've never, you know, none of them ever been to church, and it's like, what do you do? Well, his sister had turned 16, and, you know, so started driving, and that summer after our senior year, she wrecked the family car, and he kind of called this family meeting that the parents are going to make her pay for the insurance deductible, and so he calls this family meeting, and he pulls out, it's probably $1,000, pulls out $1,000 cash, and lays it down, you know, gives it to his sister, and says, look, I want to pay the insurance deductible for you. Mm-hmm. And he had not told his family he became a Christian. He says, over the course of this year, I became a Christian and I realized that Jesus paid for my sins, and I want to give you a little picture of what that looks like and pay for what you did. And I mean, again, to make a long story short, his sister ends up converting and becoming a Christian, and then his parents did as well. Through his example. Yeah, it's just unbelievable. It's just amazing.
Wow.
So
I mean, those are the things, man.
Yeah.
It has so much weight.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, and it's a conflict that's dealt with, not with the insurance company.
Yeah, right, right.
You know,
well, I mean, he saw an opportunity to serve and took it.
It's so much easier to do that when they're not Christians.
And that's a good point, too. The Japanese. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
They don't react the same way.
But yeah, I mean, that's a good point.
Take the money and run.
That's the whole thing, going back to...
Here's a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. You had kind of said that in the last meeting. You know, it makes sense that a non-Christian would know. I mean, it doesn't make sense. You know, and so that's the complacency, I think.
I sold my car on Auto Trader like 10 years ago, and the guy agreed that he signed a contract and faxed it back saying he'd pay a certain amount, and I shipped the car to South Carolina and it got there. And he was like, I'm not paying that for this. I told him about the dent and the side of it and everything, but he didn't like it when he saw it. He was like, I'm not paying you as much as I told you it was. I called my lawyer friend, who's also a Christian, and I was like, can you give me, write something on a letterhead so I can send it to him, just scare him at least. And he's like, well, first you gotta ask, you need to see if he's a Christian first. And I was like, so I called him, and I'm like, hoping the whole time he's not. I want to sue the same thing. Of course, right when I ask, he's like, yeah, I mean, I can't test those claims, and I didn't preface it by saying, if you're not, then
I'm suing you.
But it was like, he did that, and then I ended up taking a loss on the car, just based on my friend's counsel of not going to courts and not using that, secular litigation with another believer, and suffering if you have to. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a fun lesson because I was right out of college. I needed the money.
To Patrick.
But to Patrick. Hey. Yeah. I hope that wasn't the to your own horn picture.
No, I think it's a great story.
But I think I'm asking more so, is that the way that's supposed to operate? Because all I did was ask a simple question, I had to take the guy at his word. He could have easily been not a Christian. And
what does it mean to be a Christian in South Carolina?
Would you talk to his pastor to work that out?
Absolutely. I think if you want to take the next step, I think that would have been the step to take. But I would say to just let yourself, Paul says, it's better to let yourself be wronged.
You're overlooking.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have done it at all, by the way, had I not received counsel to do that.
Yeah.
At all. I was already fired up. Any kind of controversial situation, I'm ready.
Assault.
I'm ready to. I had 4 years of college against foreigners who were playing for their scholarship, so.
So you got the gladiator suit on a different fight.
I learned how to just
drive like a gladiator.
I learned that everyone's a cheater, basically, and they're always out to cheat you out of something. So I developed a smart mouth because of that.
And that's the thing, when you really seem to grow up thinking that, everybody's in it for himself. And heck, our culture tells you that over and over and over again, right? Wants you to believe it. Feeds you that way, right? So these countercultural moves, is that city on the hill, right?
What'd the guy say? And you just like nothing, said whatever.
Nothing. He just expected it, kind of.
Man, that's a hard, like you said, that's a hard lesson.
Expected that I owed it to him. Even I sent him as is, signed the price, and everything. I didn't get the money, ahead of time. I waited for him to get the car to give me the money.
Do you have to go
back? That's just a tactical mistake.
You went and got the car back then.
No, I shipped it from Birmingham to South Carolina. Never ship a car.
Gotcha.
So.
Wow.
He
you gave the guy the car?
No.
He still paid you. He just paid you less.
It was a few hundred dollars.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It was shipping. I paid for the shipping and the cost of the car. He's like, I'm only going to pay you this much for the car.
Wow. Okay.
So what? He still paid me like 90 or 80% of it.
Okay.
So it wasn't a bad loss.
Okay.
More principal thing.
That's hard.
But that is interesting to me, the whole concept of the ecumenical conversation. How do you resolve those conflicts between churches where one pastor is trying to stick up for his congregant and the other pastor is doing the same thing? That's a good chance for church unity.
Yeah.
There's not a lot in this book about handling theological conflict, but a lot of the principles he lays out, I think, certainly apply. I think to some degree we have to be willing to allow differences that have arisen over the centuries of church history to stand and recognize that there are going to be men of good faith and goodwill who end up disagreeing. And you know, if, let's say, Proverbs has a lot to say about conflict resolution, I think the book of Ecclesiastes reminds us that you can't fix everything in this life. There are some things that just are beyond our ability to fix. And so you have to learn how to live with those things. You have to learn to live with those things that you can't, that there's no, you know, that this aren't fixable. But I think what would change things is not if, you know, all of a sudden tomorrow all of the, you know, walls between Christian denominations tumbled down and we were all one big church. As wonderful as that might be, that's not realistic. Providentially, God has not created a situation where that can happen in that kind of way. But I think what would be great and would be a very strong witness is if Christians within various traditions treated one another with kindness and respect in dealing with those differences. And of course found, this is a John Frame kind of thing, you know, if we were quick to look for as much common ground as we can find.
And that's a quick way to show unity.
Which in any conflict is what you ought to be doing, is looking for as much common ground as you can find. What about chapter 3?
First of all, he's talking about God's sovereignty. The John Piper quote, people lift their hand to rebel against the Most High, only to find that their rebellion is unwitting service in the wonderful designs of God. It's an interesting, good way of describing kind of how sin gets used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has decreed that there be acts that are sins.
Yeah. God uses evil for
you. You know, I'll show you.
It's like the most,
I know you will.
It's the most Pipery quote I've ever read.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen some of that joy. And
I think, you know, the gist of this chapter, as I recall, is we need to recognize that, you know, all of our trials in life are orchestrated by God's sovereignty for His glory and our good, and that includes our relational conflicts. And so, you know, think about the example of Joseph. You know, Joseph had great conflict with his brothers. He was the victim of their betrayal. And how does Joseph deal with that in the end? Because he understands that God is the one who is ultimately behind it all, he stands ready to forgive them. And that's how we ought to look at it. You read a story like that, and of course, you know, you get to the end of the Joseph story, and we're amazed by and have this high degree of respect for Joseph because we see him forgiving. Well, put the conflicts in your life in that story. When somebody wrongs you, think about it in terms of, you know, now you're Joseph. And, you know, you haven't been wronged as badly as Joseph, but you've been wronged. And so now how will you be able to say, you meant it for evil, but God turned it out for good? Can you say that with Joseph? Mm-hmm. And saying that is, I think, one huge thing that really empowers forgiveness, is understanding that in the sovereign plan of God, this really does, in some way, promote your ultimate salvation and growth in Christ-likeness. And therefore, you can accept it as a part of your life story and not let it ruin the story. You know, even the dark chapters still lead to a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Earlier it talked about every response to conflict costs you something you must give. One thing to gain another. Out in the margin I wrote death and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to trust the Lord in the midst of conflict means trusting that the pattern set out in the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus, regardless of how bad things seem, if you're faithful, there will be a resurrection on the other side. And it may not look like the resurrection you thought it would, but there will always be a resurrection.
And the faithfulness, you're saying being faithful means dying.
Yes.
Or death. Yeah.
Yeah, being faithful.
Touching them through the death for the resurrection.
That's right. Being faithful to maybe the pattern and the tactic of reconciliation that Christ has laid out for his people.
That's very practical too. Mm-hmm. You know, just be with practicals. I mean, you know, it should make us fall on our knees, make us fall on our knees and trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, it keeps you moving forward too, instead of dwelling on it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, past wrongs. It's like forgiveness is, or peacemaking is like a forward-looking process.
Yeah, it's not dwelling on it. That's another thing, you know. I don't get into later, but golly, it can be hard to forget.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's why it's good looking for resurrection on the other side of the mess. It's always there.
Somewhere. Well, think about it in terms of those relationships that are strained by conflict. To absorb the wrong, to forgive the wrong that's been done against you is a death. The resurrection on the other side is the now healed and you could say re-glorified, restored relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about how many opportunities you have to do that in marriage. Or how many opportunities you give your spouse to do that.
Jeff Steele told my brother right before he was going to go out to the altar, he said, "You see that cross out there?
You're walking to your death.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. This young college student. It was overwhelming.
There's that book, The Mystery of Marriage, by
it's a great book. Yeah.
That's how he starts out. That marriage is suicide. Oh, that's not what I was thinking.
It's great. Thanks.
Chapter 4. I mean, the chapter title asks a great question. Is this really worth finding over? I assume you guys have the same chapters as me.
Yeah. Next part to get the log out of your eye.
There's a lot of wisdom in this chapter. A lot of wisdom in this chapter.
We're so easy to assault. To attack.
So let me ask you guys a question.
Man.
When do you confront somebody about their sin?
Always.
I know, man. An easy answer is if they're hurting themselves, and of course, then how you define that. But. Or if it's. I guess when you're thinking about the others around them hurting them too, hurting themselves and the others around them. And I mean, again, defining that.
Mouth off a page at, one in the morning after Knox has just woke us up or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's an opportunity to let love cover the multitude of my off mouthing. But if it were to become a pattern,
Then
that would be might be the opportunity.
Or I guess also a weight of something, one time but weighty enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm also the thing about the pattern, like that's good advice for people who see one another frequently, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
I have had opportunities though, and have taken them where I've been around. I remember a couple of instances of like being up at Boyce College in Louisville with Brian, hanging out with some dudes, and they were acting in a very unchristlike way, and I didn't know them.
Yeah.
But it seemed, I don't know, maybe it was just the surroundings, and like, mm-hmm. I was out with a bunch of kids who I thought were supposed to be pursuing godliness and, acting terribly. So I said, "Man, why are you talking like that? Or what's the deal? I mean, is this what you do when you go to Bible college?" Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there was some try to put them down subtly, they do. But opportunities like that where it's, I don't know, opportunities where you, I don't know, maybe it's a spirit prompting thing.
Time for a general rebuke and time for a moral. Serious conversation. It kind of just depends on, again, it's like child rearing,
mm-hmm.
conflict resolution. I'd be spanking those kids 24/7 if I stopped them every time. Yeah. You know, it's,
well, so a couple things here that I think are significant. One is, I like his distinction between material and personal issues. I mean, I think that's very helpful. So under section define the issues, you know, he talks about how there are material issues, which is basically the facts of the matter. You know, what are the substantive issues that are
what
not being agreed upon?
Everybody could see.
Right. But then he also talks about the personal issues, things like people's attitudes, feelings, motives, words, behavior, conduct towards one another. Obviously, those things are every bit as important as the material issues for a Christian. Mm-hmm. Because for a Christian, it's not enough to be right about the issue. You've got to be right in how you conduct yourself as well. In fact, I think in some ways it'd be better to be wrong about the issue and right about how you treat people than the other way around if you look at the priorities of Jesus. I mean, maybe it's not totally accurate to say that, but it almost seems that way.
I think true restoration goes past material into the personal.
Exactly. Yeah, if you settle the material issue without dealing with the personal issues, you have not resolved the conflict.
Well, Jesus never gets it wrong. It always gets both right. Might not be the best example. But I know what you're trying to get at. What's a better model for that?
Well, think about how Paul talks about the strong and the weak, like in the end of Romans, and he says that, you know, the strong should not use their strength to cause the weak to stumble. In other words, the strong are right about the material issues, but they're wrong about how they deal with the personal issues, because the way that they deal with them at a personal level is causing some of the weak to stumble. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the, you know, I think that's just the kind of thing that the book is talking about here. That's in view. It would have been better for the strong to be right about the personal issue than the material issue. Mm-hmm. Basically, is I think what Paul's saying in Romans 14 and 15.
He gives pretty good practical aspect, with his wife on that next page.
Okay, I don't think I've got that story.
Let's see.
Start, for example, when I come home from a long trip.
Yeah, I don't have that one.
So it's pretty helpful. First, stop dragging in more issues. Try to agree on the primary issues, material issues. Then identify the primary personal issues.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's the thing. We can all agree on the material
in
issues.
In conflicts,
right?
With your spouse, yeah, I mean, this is totally relevant.
Right.
And the tendency is for men to focus on the material issues and women on the personal issues. Yes. I mean, that's the way it usually goes.
So we need to start saying, hey, let's stick to the material. Yeah. But I mean, really, but I think that also...
That's exactly right, Greg. That's what we need.
Yep.
Call us. That's
how that goes. I don't
have every doubt for you. Hey, call me when you guys are sleeping.
It's nice and warm outside.
Just say, Hannah, you're missing the material issues.
Exactly.
But I mean, if they're going to focus more, I'm not trying to turn this into a guy in real estate, sorry. But I mean, I think that it's giving on both sides, we're probably going to list out the material more. They're going to list out the personal more. I think us real recognizing...
Well, they're probably more in tune with the personal. And
they definitely are.
We probably are oblivious to that and only focused on the material.
I know, I've noticed that. But I mean, I can see how they just really do feed on each other in a way that can be hard to, you know, especially if something is brewing for a while. You know, one thing begets the other, it seems, you know. I'm not talking about just at home, I'm talking about just neighborhood conflicts or you know, work or whatever.
Well, so then we get into the whole question of what sins do we actually confront? And he's got this section, overlook minor offenses, and you got all these Bible verses. A man's wisdom gives him patience. It is his glory to overlook an offense. Okay, to do something that is glorious is to do something godlike, because God is glorious. So to overlook an offense, to simply absorb it without making a big to-do over it, is a godlike thing to do. It's glorious. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. Love is like a blanket that you just throw over the sin and hide it and cover it over. And it can't be seen anymore. the issue that's already been raised here at the table, of course, is, well, okay, if West sins count as minor, mm-hmm. I mean, how do you know when it's a minor sin? It's interesting, you know, like what he says here, he says, this does not mean we must overlook all sins. It does require that we make every effort to overlook inconsequential wrongdoing. So obviously, all of this is relative, and it is a matter of wisdom. I mean, in one sense, you could say all sin is consequential. All sin has consequences. That would be true. But some sins are greater than others. Some sins are more severe. Some sins can be overlooked, whereas others cannot. So he talks about two conditions here. First, the offense should not have created a wall between you and the other person or caused you to feel differently toward him or her for more than a short period of time. So that's where you're asking, okay, can I simply absorb what was, you know, the wrong that was done to me? Can I simply absorb it and move forward and not treat this person or view this person any differently? Second, the offense should not be doing serious harm to God's reputation, to others, or to the offender. Then he gives a key, what I think is a real key. If you decide to overlook an offense, you should not simply file it away in your memory for later use against the other person. Instead, you actually forgive it. So here's what we tend to do. Especially, you know, those of us who don't like conflict, you know, who want to avoid confrontation. Somebody sins against you, and you're not willing to go to them and confront them about it because that would be difficult.
Mm-hmm. It's the work, right?
That takes work and, you know, courage to go and do that. So you're not going to go talk to them about it. But you will go talk to a lot of other people about it. You will never believe what so-and-so did to me. And so, you know, you haven't thrown the blanket of love over it to cover it, but you haven't gone to the person either. You've gone to other people, or if you do bring it up with that person, what you do is what's described here. You wait till an opportune time when you want to jab them in some way, and then, you know, at that opportune moment, you bring it up and you say, well, remember that time 5 months ago.
Or to absolve yourself of a sin.
Or say that again?
To absolve yourself of a sin.
Okay, yeah.
In other words, you bring it up saying, well, you know, 3 months ago, you did this.
You mistreated me, and that's why. Yeah.
Well, you did the same thing
to me. I mean, Patrick needs to go find a used car that guy that bought and buy it and have it shipped and then send the guy, you know, 80%. Ha! You know, gotcha.
And then he presses charges. And takes you to court.
He sends you a letter from his wife. That's probably what would happen.
What if it's not sin against you, but you're privy to it. You're the only person privy to it.
Only person privy, yeah, that's a good question.
Someone else.
I think that second qualification then really kicks into effect.
Is that what you're saying? Another person sinning
against someone else.
Serious harm to others.
In other words, extreme example, if you saw somebody's husband or wife out with another person, that would be an extreme example, something like that. I mean,
yeah.
That's an extreme example.
Yeah, or adultery that only you know.
Yeah.
You do the same thing? I mean, or do you immediately go to church later?
Well, I would say if it's that's not a minor sin.
Okay.
So I'd say that.
Dealt with differently?
Yeah.
So yeah, when it's willful, high-handed. There's so many hypotheticals,
yeah.
But
I know, yeah.
If it's willful sin and the person has stated that they're going to do something that they know is wrong, is that sin in and of itself? Before the actual act, maybe homosexuality is a good example. Somebody struggles with same-sex attraction, and you know they're not actively engaging in acts. Do you confront that? Is that minor? Is that major? You just warn them about design and nature and where they're headed.
So you're asking the question of when in that case?
Yeah, I mean, do you just let them?
I think in a case like that, I think what you have is a person who's going to need a lot of ongoing instruction and encouragement and accountability mm-hmm. to deal with their disordered desires.
Yeah.
So I would say that's a case where you shouldn't just ignore it, and it's not possible to just let love, quote unquote, cover it and not say anything about it. You have to be. But I think that's a ministry then that you're carrying on to that person.
Right.
It's not so much that you're confronting their sin as it is they need to have the gospel continually preached to them. They need to be reminded of why God has commanded them to live the way he has, and they need accountability and encouragement and prayer and all that kind of thing because of this, you know, particular area of weakness.
But what if the, you know, what if the person on the other side, you know, what if this guy or girl that's about to commit this act is going to, you know, bring down another brother who also struggles with that.
Yeah, then I think you definitely have to insert yourself in the situation, and probably with, you know, even help from the church. I mean, just like I would say if you knew two people in the church who were, you know, plotting a getaway weekend to commit adultery with each other, same kind of thing. I don't think you'd...
What do you do? I mean, what am I supposed to do?
I think you confront them about it, and I think if that doesn't get immediate results, I think you bring in other outside friends or... And officers from the church.
Would you talk to those friends first before you confront?
I'd say you're starting a Matthew 18 process with that person.
Yeah. Okay.
You're starting a Matthew 18 process.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Another kind of, I guess, kind of thought on this is, when are you too sensitive?
Because some people,
you know, he talks about that at the beginning.
Yeah.
When is it that, hey, maybe you need to, and I know, again, it comes back to the log in the eye. How can you be discerning about how sensitive you are? You know, like...
Yeah, and
different sensitivities would, I guess, call something offensive or not, right?
Yeah. Some people are overly sensitive. They get their feelings hurt way too easily, and so they're constantly, you know, wanting to confront somebody to talk it out. And oftentimes the people who have offended them are really not that sensitive, and they're not that sympathetic or empathetic, and they didn't even realize they hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
And so it's news to them. Yeah, you know, they had no idea. And those are situations where probably both sides need to move some in order to avoid future conflict.
Gotcha.
I think that's both sides of that situation where you, which is why it's surrounding yourself with brothers and with the leaders that you can trust and go to and be in constant fellowship and contact with, to where you have someone that's safe to, you know, you can, whether through its regular accountability sessions or just in through a normal organic friendship, where you are, you know, constantly being monitored, it's a bad word, but, you know, you're constantly being watched and observed.
Accountable, in
a healthy way, where you're not living a life of isolation, running around either being too sensitive or too passive. It's what the church organically is supposed to be, right? Where we're holding each other accountable, where we're saying,
hey man, don't worry about it.
Greg, every time somebody looks at you sideways, quit getting so upset about it, or. You know, or Patrick, maybe you need to come in front, you know, whatever, on that person, on that, you know, where we have regular opportunity to seek counsel and see through friendships and through.
And it is kind of that constant accountability, too, to that, so, yeah.
He's got a section on rights, and just because you have a legal right doesn't mean you should claim that right. There are times to stand on your rights. Paul does that, saying... the book of Acts, where, you know, he insists on a trial. On the other hand, there are times to give up your rights, which is what Paul talks about doing in 1 Corinthians 9. I think we face this in our own culture. Should Christians use constitutional protections for, say, free speech to be able to preach what the Bible says about homosexuality or, you know, any number of other issues you could point to? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a good example of using our rights in order to ensure that we can preach the gospel. But there are certainly also a lot of opportunities through the course of life where the best thing to do is to forego your rights. You could claim a right, but you give it up because that's what would be more effective in the spread of the gospel.
Do you want to tell us what they would think?
So
do you want to other?
Yeah.
You would have him do it to you.
So he says there's a lot of good things here. He talks about, you know, Paul's standing up for his rights in Acts 16, in Acts 22, and Acts 25. On the other hand, you know, like in 1 Corinthians 9, he talks about his rights as an apostle, but he gave up a lot of those rights in order to make his ministry more effective. So rights are simply privileges given to you by God, and he wants you to use them for his glory.
And it seems like if the advancement of the kingdom is at stake, use the rights, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, let that be the overarching
kind of
principle, not what's not what's necessarily in your best self-interest, but what's in the best interest of God's kingdom.
Wow. Yeah, I know, because sometimes you want to just let those rights be known because you kind of want to teach a lesson. Like, I mean, I'm saying this very, like, that's selfishly, that's what we want to do.
Well, we live in a culture that's all about
rights.
Standing up for your rights and claiming as many rights as possible. We're constantly inventing new rights that nobody in the history of the human race has ever heard before, but now they're somehow inalienable rights. So, it's a huge problem.
Sometimes you got to fight for your right to party.
You do. Especially if you're a Baptist.
Yeah.
Foot loose.
Oh, man.
Chapter 5, examine yourself. A lot of good stuff here about...
what's your chapter 5 called?
Yeah, what's your 5?
Conflict starts in the heart.
Oh, man. Okay, you guys tell me about that one. I don't have that one.
Unless it's the same. Let's see.
No, mine's about speech. Starts with Lamentations 3:40.
The updated book corresponds a lot to the website.
It does.
Kind of what I followed along to. That's probably what that is.
Yeah, that's actually really cool.
Wow.
Progression
wow,
of an idol and stuff like that. Do you have a chapter that does
really?
That?
Really?
Progression of an idol. I desire, I demand.
Yeah, man, it was pretty good.
I judge.
And then the next,
I plunge.
And restores in part 3 after that.
So where does examine yourself come? Man,
just between
you
the two of you.
Hey, let me see if they look.
Actually, examine yourself is later, isn't it?
Speak of the truth and love.
It's not so bad.
Hey, he's giving up on that pencil.
See, it's structured around the 4 G's.
Yeah,
the 4 G's
you
do not have.
Take one, two, or
4 G's, man.
Rich, you practically have this in the book.
I do.
I don't know how we've done this to
go be right.
We got, well, we got through the first 4 chapters.
Forgive us, God forgive you.
Interesting. Because mine,
nah, I mean, there's some really good practical stuff.
Mine really only has
about an idol. So,
as long as you do steps,
time brings wisdom.
Okay, I think they're probably pretty similar.
In that chapter?
Well, I think they're probably pretty similar. It's still 3 chapters in that section. But then you've got part 3 is restore, mine is go and show. See, it's all G's, but you've got different G's.
We've got your
man.
The second generation G's.
Yeah, exactly. The third G.
Yeah, we get back into the same thing. It's just this section really is different. All the other chapters are the same. And it's the same number of chapters.
It could be examine yourself. The conflict starts
yeah,
in the heart.
It's the same. You've got a different quotation there at the beginning.
Rich have his own iPhone, his old book.
I have a right to a new book. But I'd have to read it.
That's right.
With the rights come responsibility.
That's right, yeah. Do have your rights, not to do all the, read all the sticky notes.
Well, I thought, you know, this chapter, assuming that we've got, okay, yeah, I've got the same thing. I've got idols. I've got a section on idols here.
I
yeah,
demand.
Yeah.
And
well, it's maybe worded a little bit differently, but it's similar material. But I thought there were a lot of good things here in terms of just, if you're going to deal with conflict with your brother, first you have to examine yourself. You've got to identify any sin on your side of the conflict. You've got to make sure that you're approaching the conflict in the right way. You know, so with your heart, right with God and with the right motives.
Examine yourself at a whole, yeah, okay.
So.
I bet it's this whole chapter on there. You have your failing to respect authority, breaking
yeah,
your word.
Yeah, the stuff on authority
so
was
it's
good.
It, y'all, it's in chapter 6.
The chapter...
Our examine yourself is a sub-chapter of our chapter 6.
Okay. So yeah, the stuff on respecting authority was actually really good. Just, you know, sometimes you have to salute the uniform, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it was helpful. So then what about, what's your chapter 6 called?
Confession brings freedom.
Okay, yeah, mine's free yourself from sin, so... Okay. He describes repentance as coming to your senses, and do you have the 7 A's
yeah,
of confession?
Have,
that was very good. That,
we
that's
do,
very
we
good.
Do that. That's an all same.
And now here's some things we need to talk about. Let's get into the 7 A's of confession. I think this is what we're talking about. When do you confess sin against a brother?
When you mean in a way that's
public, private, both.
Yeah. When would you go to your brother and confess, brother, I've sinned against you?
That's why you come to us now, so you don't talk about the
Lord. Yeah, that's why you punted my question from a couple weeks ago.
What was your question? What did you ask? Oh, is it related to that? Okay, yeah, here we are. So, here we go.
I think when it's hard, has a potential to harm someone else, which is always, but maybe more practically.
Tell me what you think about this. Whether sin, this is in his second paragraph, and address everyone involved. So he, you know, he says, until you are reconciled to God through confession, you'll have a very difficult time being reconciled to others. So you know, you obviously want to deal with it before God. I think of Psalm 51, where David's committed adultery and murder, and then says, "Against you only, Lord, have I sinned." But then he says this, whether a sin should be confessed to other people as well as to God depends on whether it was a heart sin or a social sin. What do you think about that distinction, heart sin versus social sin?
I think they mix too much, don't you?
Well,
I think it's his point.
I mean, I think that you end up, if you have a social sin, then you're probably going to start admitting your heart sins too in that. Like, and I also thought poorly of you. I'm sorry.
Well, a social sin certainly springs from the heart.
Yeah.
But I think the difference is it affects other people.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Since a heart sin takes place only in your thoughts, it does not directly affect others and needs to be confessed only to God. For example, if you have felt envy or jealousy toward a coworker but did not act on those feelings, it is unnecessary and may actually be unwise to tell that person what you were thinking. The same would be true if you had considered how to violate a law, hurt someone's reputation, or steal something. As long as your thoughts did not give rise to sinful actions, confession need not be made to other people. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. Definitely counter to the church evangelical small group.
Yeah.
Where you confess all your inner secret sins.
Yeah. Really? Covenant freshmen, when they come in, one of the first classes they take is very much that way. Like talked to one of the guys that was wrestling with it because he felt like everybody was it was just ugly. People just talking about the most, some racy stuff even, you know.
Wow. Well, of course.
But really, almost like...
what else goes on in the head of a bunch of college freshmen?
Seminary freshmen.
Wow. I personally...
He was like, at some point, you know, it got
the... That's not any different, I can assure you.
Kind of wallowing in this stuff, and it's almost like they think... their philosophy is you get all out on the table in order to be truly vulnerable, and in order to deal with all of your skeletons, because you're not going to be able to be a successful pastor until you actually do that, confess it out loud with a group of people that you trust, kind of thing. So I mean, I get the principle, but maybe it's unnecessary to go that far.
I think for people our age, maybe a little younger, there's sort of the Donald Miller like vulnerability as an end.
Right.
Yeah. Realness.
It's kind of how you prove your authenticity
is in
right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean,
set up a confession booth.
I knew a ton of, well, actually, I think that was kind of cool. it's participating in BCM, you know, Baptist Campus Ministry.
They just say
at AUM. Well, it was very much like that. And it, exactly what
Patrick
said. I mean, it was,
the end, yeah.
Yeah, it was super ugly. And unnecessarily so. I mean, I don't know that there's anything wrong with if you're at work and you're envious, I mean, you don't have to tell that person, but if you and I are having lunch, I'll be like, dude, man,
that's going to make it real awkward if you tell me you're envious of my wife or something like
Bro,
that.
I'm so
for
envious.
The rest of the relationship.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It's like you're still confessing.
That's where the covenant thing takes it too far. I mean, like,
I'm envious of, I mean, there's, I am the department, so that's not really a valid thing for me, but like when I was at an agency, like if I was jealous of the senior art director and the account that he got, I might realize the spirit might convict me that that's a sin. I might not tell him, dude, you know, I just want to confess to you. But you and I over lunch, I might tell you, dude, I was really struggling today, man.
Yeah.
And I'm just, yeah. So you're still confessing. It's still social. There's no point at which a human being is not social.
Yeah, bad application is when a friend of mine asked me if he should tell his boss that he doesn't feel like he's really been very productive with his time. And he's been searching articles on the internet, and he went and did it.
Against my counsel.
Did he get fired?
No, but he said it was the most awkward meeting he's ever had.
That's the worst thing.
I just stared at him like, they were just so shocked that he actually would call a meeting with the partners.
Is his end in that to just get it off his chest to them, or was it, I'm going to shock him with what I'm going to say? Kind of like an Arrested Development type thing, or like a,
like the show.
I think there's a lot of Heidi play in that.
That's what I mean. And he talks about that a little bit in here too. Anytime we use a process like the seven A's, we can turn it into a meaningless ritual and completely miss what God wants us to do. This usually happens when we use the process for our own benefit.
Yeah.
Instead of seeing it as a means to glorify God, it's to seeing what the means is for, not the end. And to serve other.
Well, it's confession with the end game manipulation, not repentance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let me throw a few things out, because I think all this is good, but a few things I've thought about this. I think we have to keep in mind that the ultimate purpose of confessing sin to someone else. So I'm not talking here about a sin. Let's say you're struggling with something and you're confessing it to someone else, and this someone else has nothing to do with the sin. You're just confessing it because you want to hear a brother pronounce God's forgiveness to you, or because you want accountability, or because you want encouragement. That's different, okay? That kind of confession can be appropriate in all kinds of circumstances. You know, you might say, I'm really struggling with anxiety over this particular issue, and I really want you to remind me of God's promises. I mean, that can be a good confession. But let's say that it's somebody that in your heart you've sinned against them and you haven't acted on it yet, so they would never know. They would never suspect that you've sinned against them in your heart this way. When do you go and confess that to them? I think the purpose of confession at that level, you know, that kind of horizontal level, certainly you should confess that to God, because that sin against God should be reconciled to Him. But the purpose of that kind of confession at the horizontal level would be reconciliation of a ruptured relationship. And if the relationship has not been ruptured, confessing might actually create a rupture.
Right.
And so therefore, it's wiser to not confess it than
Or it could create a deeper breakthrough in the relationship.
It could, and you have to decide.
Honesty and vulnerability. I mean,
right.
So it could go both ways. There's risk for sure of that, but there's also reward.
So let's just say that a very pretty woman walks into your office at work and you immediately find yourself having lustful thoughts, and then you push those thoughts away like you should. You think, but I really need to confess this to her because I sinned against her.
I'm talking about when you
guys might have a much deeper relationship.
You might be a breaker.
I'm talking about more like when somebody comes in the church and you have these preconceptions about who they are. Stereotype them. I don't know, because they seem nerdy, or they seem like they're part of circles, or they just have nerdy hobbies or something that you don't. You judge them for whatever reason. I think it could lead to deeper breakthrough, especially if they've sensed that from you.
Sure.
That hostility.
And if they've sensed it, I think it falls into a somewhat different category.
It's a social sin.
Yeah. It's no longer confined to your heart. It's actually spilled over into the way that you treat them.
But it's still ambiguous as to whether they picked up.
You're right.
And that would take.
But even then, I think it might be wiser to not confess all the negative thoughts that you had, because that could be destructive. And then actually, all of a sudden, they look at you differently, and now you're really
Is
think
prejudice
or
struggle
with
the
self doubt or something like that, like towards that or whatever.
It's
unwise.
You know, you walk up to a guy and say, man, you know, when you first walked in this church, I thought you were gay, you know, but I'm glad to know you're straight, you know, despite the limp wrist and the lisp. That's probably not a good thing.
Because you're engaged in prejudice, all day long.
Yeah, it doesn't make it not a sin. I mean, unless you're defining prejudice as, how are you defining prejudice?
Like the quick preconceived notion.
I just asked a question, bro.
We got to find our target.
There's a prejudice happening.
I don't do analytic.
You don't do Webster's either, apparently.
No, I don't. I see what you mean. I see what y'all both bring up.
Because you're passing judgments all day, every day on people. Yeah, one way or another.
Some sinful, some...
So being wrong about a judgment isn't a sin.
Yeah, there's different kinds of judgments, though. You know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah,
I do. That's sinful, why I'm asking.
So sinful prejudice then. Prejudice does not equal sin, but there can be sinful prejudice.
I just never hear prejudice used in a good sense. Like that.
Well, nobody ever gay. Gay used to be a nice way to say you were happy.
I mean, let me hear all my prejudices. I'm going to list them right under my hobbies, you know? And, no, there's no
on CV. No, but I mean...
I say my resume.
Yeah. You add a second page. For prejudices.
You're right. I mean, the connotation now is not good with prejudice. But at the same time...
I mean, at the church ecclesiology level, did you see the story about First Baptist Oxford, Mississippi?
No.
What happened?
They confessed publicly of a decision that elders made behind closed door in 1967 to officially keep African Americans out of the worship service. Because African Americans were going around doing sit-ins, just testing people to see who would... And the elders went at First Baptist Oxford and decided they voted on it without full assembly there. And it passed the measure to keep African Americans out. The pastor last year went to the local African American churches to apologize for it. And the Second Baptist Church of Oxford, which is African American congregation,
the Second Baptist Church,
responded very well and reconciled. And he said he had a lot of people that weren't in the church become Christians, but as a result of the reconciliation taking place because of their confession. And they didn't have to do that. I mean, they didn't have to do that because they didn't vote on that. Nobody's alive that voted on. Actually, there were still some people that were in the church when that decision was made, but they weren't
helping. But I think that's a key exercise in wisdom. If that had been voted on last year, or 2 years ago, I'd say, being poor.
Bad timing, yeah.
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 Bad timing to do it, but I think that, you know, exercise wisdom would say it. Well, because it's, you know, why did exercise wisdom, or why?
Why would it be bad timing ever if what you did was, if, you know...
The rupture that Richard...
I mean, saying they'd taken a vote and then corrected it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, 2 weeks later, it really hadn't had an effect on anyone. I mean, they were actively doing it, then I think it's...
Oh, okay.
But
if it was just call it church heart sin, they, 1 week they'd taken a vote, the rest of the... elder found out about it, said, no, that wasn't valid because we're all there, we're going to invalidate it and forget it and then deal with it.
Yeah, as long as it didn't go public.
Yes, it didn't,
Yeah.
But that was a public thing. Like,
yeah, it was a public thing, so I think a public confession.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was good. That was an
institution. Well, you said behind closed doors, though, so it was, in fact...
The vote was...
But it obviously had public...
Yeah, it's public ratification.
That's interesting because it does make you wonder when's the timing right. And okay, you talked about it earlier, Eric, just kind of having wisdom about timing for resolving these conflicts and things like that. Unfortunately, the way a lot of people look at that nowadays, Patrick, and I'm saying this out of a prejudice for just how things are written nowadays. There's just kind of like the whole, it was a story of Michael Over, the Blind Side. A lot of people attack that stuff, probably from a non-Christian standpoint of, oh, that's the white man trying to, be the savior or some type of, thing nowadays and stuff like that. And I think it's distorted and it's sad when the good of it, I think, is there. But, so, when is the perfect timing for that? Because you could say the perfect timing should have been maybe 1970.
Sure.
But then at that time, it would have been still maybe in the heat of the racism and would have been... bad.
Oh, it would have been pretty controversial.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or now, and then people are going to call it white.
Well, the fact is, eventually they came to grips with the sin, and they realized that it had been public, and they needed to confess it.
It was public, absolutely.
And I'm only saying as an outsider. In their context, though, I'll bet it was huge.
Yeah.
They each side understood. And I think that's maybe it comes down to context a lot of times. I don't know in terms of the wisdom to
right? Congregationalist church, so they don't have to. There wasn't any outside pressure on them to do that at all. They just
right.
Well, it's a good question to ask.
Which is something.
If you're confessing a heart sin to someone that you sin against in your heart, a good question to ask would be: will this edify the person? Right. Will this build them up, or could this tear them down? I think that if it's any risk, it'll tear them down. Then you at least seek some wise counsel, but you err on the side of not confessing that. If it's truly a heart sin,
Okay, so the first sermon I ever preached was at Redeemer Presbyterian in Austin, Texas. You know, it was like 500 people. And afterwards, a guy came up to me afterwards. I mean, it was a friend of mine. And he said, I really feel bad, but I just have to confess this to you. He said, I fell asleep during your sermon. Now, had he not confessed, I would have had no idea. And my confidence as a young preacher would not have been so shattered.
Oh, man.
That's pretty good for you, though, right? Yeah.
You probably thought you'd notice.
Well, that's the thing. He might have, but I mean, it was 500 people. I didn't notice it.
But it's a good friend of yours, and he's like, man, I might be that, you know, the face.
I would have preferred him not to have confessed.
Yeah.
He could have confessed it to God.
And whereas he feels so bad about it, because here he is supporting his friend. You know? I mean, that is hard. So.
Well, we're kind of running out of time. I do want to, if you'll jump ahead, there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, a lot of the really practical stuff is in these next few chapters. I don't know what your chapter is about restore the center gently. That's got a lot of good material in it. In terms of Matthew 18, chapter 8 has got a lot on, my chapter 8 is Speak the Truth in Love. It's got a lot on speech, you know, things like dealing with gossip, listening, you know, work on your listening skills, strive for clarity, how you communicate. Chapter 9 is about bringing others along with you. But let's jump ahead to chapter 10 on forgiveness. Let's talk about this for just a minute.
How about communicate so clearly you can't be misunderstood? That was a great quote.
Yeah.
Not so that you can be understood, but so that you can't be misunderstood. Yeah. That was really
What is your chapter 10 called?
Yeah,
Forgiveness God forgave you.
Forgiveness God, is that 10?
It's Colossians 3.
Yeah, that's what I've got too. Yeah. He starts off by saying, Christians are the most forgiven people in the world, therefore we should be the most forgiving people in the world, which of course is true. And then a little bit further down, he asks the question, and this is based on the line from the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. What would happen if God forgave you in exactly the same way you are forgiving this other person? When we pray that in the Lord's Prayer, we're basically saying, God, treat my sins the same way that I treat the sins of those who sin against me. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to forgive?
We say that a lot, too.
Yeah.
We recite the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
So, exactly. We're heaping coals on ourselves. So,
what does it mean to forgive?
I do think that he goes into the forgetting is a part. I know it's part. I think it's probably parts of it. But, I mean, golly.
He lists, on the website, he lists them in 4 points. I don't know if you'll have those.
Decision.
Their quote says, I will not dwell on this incident.
I not dwell, bring it up again, you talk about others, more or less, stand between. Yeah.
I think one thing he says here that's important is that forgiveness is not making excuses for somebody.
Right.
You can only forgive a genuine sin, a genuine wrongdoing. If it wasn't really wrong, there's nothing to forgive.
Right.
So forgiveness condemns the sin and acquits the sinner. It condemns the sin. It says what you did was really wrong and evil and needs to be condemned, but you, the sinner, I forgive. Mm. And when you forgive somebody, that is a promise to not hold what they've done against them. That's what it means to forgive. You are
a promise.
It's a promise. Okay. You're making a promise to not hold what the person has done against them, which means you won't be bringing it up again, mentally rehashing things in order to, you know, nurture bitterness.
Yeah.
It means you won't bring it up to them later and use it as a weapon against them. So it means that you're not going to use what this person has done against them anymore. Mm-hmm. As a promise.
It goes back to the death that you're talking about, or in here it talks about debt and the cost of it taking on. It's taking
and to forgive somebody,
debt.
You have to absorb that debt.
Right.
The debt doesn't go away. It just means you now absorb it. You take the hit for what was done.
I wrestle with that when they don't learn any lessons from it, or they don't correct.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you'd be mad at that guy, Dr. Armand.
No, I mean, I think I have more of a, well, no, I mean, more so that I would be mad if he did that to somebody else and taking my charity and taking it for granted. Kind of, I'm like, is this person going to change course or not? That shouldn't be a condition on how thoroughly I forgive, but it is.
Well, that raises another question. Yeah. Is forgiveness conditional?
Man, not the 7 times 7. Is forgiveness conditioned on someone else asking for it? Like, does there need to be a genuine verbal transaction, if you will? Almost like the absolution, like it's something that you need to hear from your ears.
Well, I said forgiveness is a promise.
Yeah.
Let me add to that, forgiveness is an interpersonal transaction between the sinner and the one sinned against. Yeah. So let's say you've sinned against somebody and you go to them and you say, I have sinned against you, I did X, I should not have, will you please forgive me? That's like you've bounced the basketball to them and now they're holding it.
Mm-hmm.
And now will they say, I forgive you, and complete the pass, bounce it back to you, or not? And this is one thing, and you know, a lot of y'all have probably done this with your kids, but something we try to do with our kids. When you've really done something wrong, don't just say, I'm sorry. Because all that does is it describes how you feel, mm-hmm. but it doesn't leave the other person with anything to do. When you say, will you forgive me, now there's you're requesting action on the part of the other person. Yeah. And that way you can actually bring about healing and restoration in the relationship. What I would say is this. Let's say somebody sins against you and they don't come and ask forgiveness. I don't think that means in the meantime you can be growing in bitterness against them. I think you have to be ready to forgive. You have to be poised to forgive. There has to be a kind of implicit forgiveness that you're so ready to grant. In some sense, you've already granted it. But the transaction of forgiveness can't take place until there's that request, and then that request is fulfilled.
Once that never happens,
then it doesn't happen.
Then it doesn't happen.
Overlook it.
We think about God and our sins. I mean, how many sins do we not confess to God? We're aware of, we don't even think about.
Yeah.
Right, which is why we do confess the fact of our sinfulness,
mm-hmm.
you know, say in corporate confession. You know, we're confessing, we know we commit all kinds of sins we're not even aware of. So we confess those in a general kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. But what I would say is, you know, God does forgive all of those sins. But I would say we don't experience God's forgiveness the same way without confession.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we can say, well, God forgives us whether we confess it or not, so therefore I don't need to confess. I think the fact is, yes, God does forgive our sin, but we don't experience forgiveness in the same way if we refuse to confess it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it affects the relationship.
It affects the relationship.
In some ways. So
David talks about this in Psalm 32. He says, as long as I concealed my sin, my bones rotted away. And then when he got his sin out in the open and confessed it to God and experienced God's forgiveness, that's when health and peace were restored.
So it seems hard to just let that be the status quo. If someone hasn't asked for forgiveness, you know that it's a lower quality of a relationship.
Yeah.
Like, but how do you just live with that? So I want to provoke them to ask for forgiveness. I want to make them forgive it, because we have...
Well, maybe not guilt, but is it ever appropriate to prompt someone for a confession or to ask?
Yeah.
You need to ask me for forgiveness.
Or it can be, you know...
Is it ever appropriate?
But it's for their own good, because this relationship is not going
to
be...
Well, I think it's going to the point where is there that wall built up between you and him or whatever, even front, you know, that's when you have to go and...
Well, we know already from Scripture already looked at, there are lots of cases where you do forgive sin committed against you without there being that confession. Love covers a multitude of sins. So when somebody doesn't confess to you, you can still throw the blanket of love over it. So you can still, you know, forgive it and cover it in that way. But you don't get the fullness of forgiveness. I'll put it that way. You don't get the fullness of forgiveness apart from the confession and granting of it.
So... Black people, black Baptists in Oxford, who potentially knew what was going on, but forgave
by the power of the Spirit,
forgave that congregation for doing what they did. The forgiveness wasn't asked until potentially they were long gone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
So it makes you wonder about how quickly our society, even Christians, how quick we are to call for an apology.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, to take to the public and say, you know, I mean, it seems like every other day on SportsCenter, some ball players being called to apologize by this interest group because of
And so what happens in a culture like ours? Well, I mean, you know, it varies case by case, but in a lot of cases, we're pressured to confess stuff and ask forgiveness for stuff that wasn't sinful.
Mm.
I mean, that's also an issue in our culture.
It talks about having an attitude of forgiveness, the two-stage process, if they haven't repented. So you have an attitude of forgiveness, but there is a granting of forgiveness that comes with their confessed or their
posture of forgiveness followed by the actual transaction.
Yeah.
And that's hard because, golly, it's hard not to dwell. But praying for that other person, he gives you good practical applications here, but that does seem the way that really God can change our attitude and really give us that posture by praying for that other person. Literally, praying for that person who did you wrong.
It's true. Right? And I can testify to that. I mean, in moments of conflict, like where I feel super justified for being mad or upset or whatever, like literally stopping and saying, acknowledging my own sinfulness, my own, inability to forgive consistently or whatever, praying for that other person. Yeah. I mean, it really is.
It can change that posture.
So and that happening repeatedly.
Yeah.
Is formative.
It's helpful for somebody on the outside too of the situation to actually affirm whether you should be expecting, to be asked for forgiveness, because otherwise you start thinking, well, is this wrong? I mean,
I know it. Well, that's a good point too.
You gotta bring somebody else into it. Otherwise, you just start going crazy. Or I start going crazy psychologically. Like, they're telling me that I'm crazy for even thinking that.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
That's why I need you to come in and be like, no, you're right, bro. You got heirs to that apology.
Hey, in a marriage relationship, has anybody ever read This Momentary Marriage by Piper?
Pretty good.
He makes a distinction between sins and strangenesses, like things that are like legitimately sinful, and the difference between things that might feel sinful from the other person but are just like personality quirks.
Differences,
Like prejudice.
You're not gonna win that
order. Let's call Anthony.
No, just write a definition.
Let's call A Brad.
But he talks about that replacement principle too in this chapter, which is kind of helpful. What you were kind of talking about too, and with prayer, pray for, but trying to think about positive things opposed to negatives. For that person. Just finding that dwelling, I think that can be hard for that unforgiven thing. I think that, Patrick, you're touching on a lot of stuff. That can be hard to deal with.
Yeah.
It's unresolved. It's unforgiven. It's whatever.
It's hard for you to experience joy.
Exactly.
In that relationship.
Exactly. That when you interact with that person, you can't help but go back and think to, wow, we're interacting in a very superficial way, not in a deep way, not a deep sense, not a joyous sense, because there's this, like, a elephant in the room or skeleton in the closet type thing, because you haven't been able to truly get to that. And, the replacement principle is a good way to kind of think of, the best way to, kind of deal with that person. And part of it, too, could be, God is using that for a reason.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with telling someone else and asking them to get a prompt that other thing, especially if this is happening to them.
No, they talk about that. Intermediaries and stuff, too. I mean, certainly. Yeah,
not like a legal or like a arbitration thing, but more like they don't recognize they're wrong. So, I mean, do you have a problem with going around telling somebody else? Because then, even if that person who did something wrong to you now knows that you told someone else to go tell them to do that, that might make it worse, but...
Does saying it out loud help answer your question?
What do you mean? Oh, no. I want to know if you've ever done that.
I'm not sure I totally followed.
So if somebody wronged you and they didn't realize that they wronged you or they didn't believe that they wronged you, you were going to someone else to tell them what happened.
To basically say, okay, yeah. Can't ever recall doing that.
Forgiveness triangle.
The forgiveness triangle.
Passive aggressive triangle.
You know, there might be situations where you would need to do something like that. I'd also ask in situations like that, is this a case where maybe you could just let love cover it?
Yeah. No.
It certainly keeps things a lot simpler.
This isn't one of those cases.
Well, and even like the, you know, Matthew 18.
I mean, look,
you
honestly,
bring in another person, but that's
okay,
only
yeah.
after trying to...
Or let me come at it this way. That's what a lot of, like, say, marital counseling is.
Yeah.
Is basically the husband saying to the counselor, will you tell my wife that she's really innocent, and vice versa. The yeah. wife to the counselor, will you tell my husband he's, you know... I mean, that's what a lot of it is. So, yeah, there are cases where that would be appropriate. We can close with this. I think his little section here on Indeed is really good. He gives a C.S. Lewis quote, which I love. Don't waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as we do this, we find one of the great secrets. When you're behaving as if you love someone, you will presently come to love him. We think that action's always going to follow feeling, and it does, but it can also work the other way around. Sometimes feeling will follow the action. This is one of the great secrets, as Lewis calls it here, one of the great secrets of liturgy. You may not feel particularly humble, you know, one Sunday. In fact, you might feel really prideful. But the liturgy requires you to kneel and confess, to bow before God and confess sin. It imposes a kind of humility on you. And if you go through that, you know, through the bodily motions and verbal expression, it can actually put humility in your heart that wasn't there before. Sometimes, yeah, we always think of things working from inside out, and that's certainly true, but sometimes things work outside in also. And he's got the great Thomas Edison story about forgiveness. You know, they were developing the incandescent light bulb. It took hundreds of hours to manufacture a single bulb. One day after finishing a bulb, he handed it to a young errand boy and asked him to take it upstairs to the testing room. As the boy turned and started up the stairs, he stumbled and fell, and the bulb shattered on the steps. Instead of rebuking the boy, Edison reassured him and then turned to his staff and told them to start working on another bulb. When they completed it several days later, Edison demonstrated the reality of his forgiveness in the most powerful way possible. He walked over to the same boy, handed him the bulb, and said, please take this up to the testing room.
I'm going to be very cynical here. I read that story and I was like, but man, what if he really liked the process of like creating the bulb?
Even so, he had to be very eager to have the thing tested to see whether it actually worked. But I think sometimes...
I'm just saying.
I don't think a lot of people around him probably didn't share that sentiment.
I don't think the point of that story is to say we should always be shielding people from the consequences of their actions, okay?
Right.
You know what? If y'all were over at my house one Tuesday night and, you know, you kind of wandered off in the house and I walked in and saw you pulling some cash out of my wallet to steal. Oh, you know, I'm sorry.
This
you know, momentary grief. Okay, I could forgive you for that, but next time you came over, I would probably hide my wallet. Okay, there are consequences. So forgiving somebody and trusting them can be two different things. You can forgive somebody and it can, you know, immediately, and it still take a while to,
okay,
you know, to restore trust and for the other aspects of the
Which,
relationship to be restored.
I mean, the slippery slope of that is, you know, I guess the difficulty in a lot of just, I mean, the culture and stuff like that of, you know, we can't have our 10-year-old, you know, we can't drop off our 10-year-old kids to go play at Aladdin's Castle anymore because we're afraid of the story of, you know. Sorry.
Sorry.
Oh, the arcade? Aladdin's Castle, the arcade.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. We're used to,
but I mean, you used to be able to do that, but since then you hear the stories of,
right,
you know, the pedophiles and the people. They
gravitate
and the
to
sex
those places.
Trafficking and stuff like that. Right. And so, yeah, I mean, you in your heart, I guess, forgive those type things, but are acting out of not forgetting? I don't know. Maybe that's wrong.
Well, I think there's a difference between forgiving and being stupid.
I got
you. So you can forgive somebody, you know, right. Again, you can forgive. And forgiveness does not mitigate all consequences.
Right.
If I'm a store owner and you pull a gun on me and say, empty the cash register, you know, and then you get caught by the police, you can confess your sin to me and say, oh, you know, I wish I hadn't done that. Will you please forgive me? And I can say, I forgive you. And, you know, you're going to make restitution. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, there still can be consequences. There
gotcha.
Still can be consequences.
Okay. Yeah. Like you said, it doesn't stop the consequences.
It doesn't stop all consequences. It may mitigate some.
And the future consequences of it, too.
But not necessarily all. Yeah,
you know?
I mean it's all kind
of... Lance Castle is saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, or just even the liberty of, you know, some of the things that change in society because of that. So...
Yeah, so, I mean, forgiveness has to be distinguished from consequences. There may still be consequences. There shouldn't be interpersonal consequences, but there may be other... Well, I should even qualify that. There can be interpersonal consequences in the sense of things like rebuilding trust. I mean, I've seen this in cases of where there was adultery in a marriage, and the couple stays together and decides to work it out, but that's still a process, you know, of healing and rebuilding trust from the marriage. It takes time. I mean, just because... One spouse says to another, I forgive you for what you did, doesn't mean that they're going to act like nothing ever happened, obviously. So, because something did. So that, you know, and that doesn't go away just because you say I forgive you. So, I'll put it this way. Forgiveness doesn't change what happened. Forgiveness doesn't change the past. Forgiveness changes the future.
Okay.
What I like about the Edison story is it shows the power of forgiveness. When you forgive somebody and you know, and that there's a follow-through to that forgiveness, it can really have an incredible transformative and empowering effect, which I think God's forgiveness of us does. To know that, you know, where did Luther's boldness come from? It came from knowing that he was forgiven, because he knew he was a sinner, but he knew God had forgiven his sins and declared him righteous, and that gave him courage to do all kinds of incredible things.
That's why, pretty courageous to... nail that to the door right there, and the ramifications, the consequences you knew would be coming. But okay, and again, it goes back to the glorifying God. We're talking about the 4 G's. It's not results; it's glorifying God.
Right. All right. So we did not get to ministries of mercy. So, do you guys want to try again? Do one more after Thanksgiving?
Yeah,
I would. Yeah,
that's a great book.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
See, I already have a marked up one of those.
And
I don't have
yours looks different.
Yeah, I have one of those.
Well, no, I can't find one of these at a bar. Jimmy's. I thought it was in the boxes somewhere. Apparently it's not.
So, we could say December 9th is when it would have to be.
That's probably better. Boys, I'm speaking for our wives here. My wife was planning on doing some type of like mom's thing. You know, thing that all of our wives would have been invited to because they've been involved.
Sex.
You do? Okay. So, I think the 9th works for me, too.
Okay.
I think.
As far as I know.
All right. Let's plan on that.
Okay.
Okay.